You're alive.
Yeah. Holy shit, you made it too.
I know that Hav is wrecked. What is your status?
We're down here at the little rover, what's its name, and with Birchill and Pettingill.
Got no food and water. Amy's got a Mustang. And, oh yeah, we can breathe.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love fun. And it's time for Kill Me Cast. Yeah, it's time for Kill Me Cast.
Welcome to Kill Me Cast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome all the Val Pals out there listening to a new episode of KilmerCast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly engrossing American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we'll be checking out Kilmer's role as a space mechanic in the 2000s sci-fi flick Red Planet. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is IO News editor and Tango and Cash aficionado, Cheryl Eddy. Cheryl, how are you doing today?
Tango and Cash aficionado?
I did read that you were a fan of the film, so unless I'm getting bad information.
yes, I believe that is accurate. Although I will say it's IO9 is the website, not IO.
Oh, okay. Yeah. IO9. Sorry. Yeah.
So plug in my spot there.
You gotta plug it. That's the whole game, right? So we now exist in a post-Dune world. You know, everybody's who is wanting to see Dune has probably seen Dune at this point, the new one. So what are you looking forward to next in the world of science fiction?
Dune 2, which was just announced.
I guess you have to after Dune 1, right? Because it's not exactly a full film, really.
Yeah. No, I am looking forward to that, but I'm also looking forward to tie into Red Planet. The new Matrix movie starring Carrie Ann Moss, who's I'm sure we'll be discussing today.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. I'm not super excited about the new Matrix. I don't know what it is. Not that, I mean, I enjoyed the first trilogy. I just, some reason I'm not hyped up about it.
I'm excited. I mean, I love Keanu Reeves. I feel like he can pretty much do no wrong. If you ever start doing Reeves Cast podcast, you can count on me to come back. But I'm intrigued to see what they're going to do with it. I mean, it's been a while since 1999, since the first movie. So a lot of new ideas to explore.
I trust that it's going to be good because obviously, like you said, you know, when, with Keanu Reeves, how could it be bad? Yeah. Although I guess there's Lake House. So, I mean, but I'm like, I'm curious what's going to be new. I'm really... You know, after three films where they've explored it so deeply, the philosophy and the world of the Matrix, I'm curious what you can come up with new, especially when so much time has passed since those films and so many films have tried to touch on similar themes, that is there anything left for them to play in this world?
Mm-hmm. And so many movies that came after were so influenced by, they just sort of took that story and kept it going a little bit.
Yeah. You know what I saw today I'm actually kind of really excited about is the trailer for Finch. Have you seen that?
Oh, I haven't seen it. The Tom Hanks plus dog plus robot.
Yeah. I mean, I watched it and I was like, wow, this kind of looks pretty good, even though it's Apple TV. So that means most people won't watch it. But, you know, it actually looked like an engaging film. And I don't know who does the voice of the robot. It's really entertaining to hear that voice because, and we'll talk a bit about that today. I always like a good AI in a film, an AI with a real good personality, like GLaDOS from Portal or, you know, obviously 2001 HAL. So to see Tom Hanks play off an AI, that feels like it's going to be really entertaining and enjoyable.
And it's the director is, he made some of the best Game of Thrones episodes. I know that show kind of lost itself at the end, but he did a lot of the good Battle of the Bastards kind of stuff. So it should be, at least he knows how to do action.
Yeah, and also I saw something called The Adam Project. Have you heard of that?
No.
So The Adam Project is a reteaming of Ryan Reynolds and Sean Levy, who did Free Guy, which I don't know how you felt about it, but I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that film.
Entertaining.
Yeah. And so this time, Ryan Reynolds plays a time traveler who goes back in time to find his 13-year-old self to help him save the world. And so I'm like, that's a lot of pressure on a 13-year-old to say that you're going to grow up to be Ryan Reynolds. But it's coming out on Netflix apparently in a couple months. But I haven't heard anything about it. So it's kind of weird that it flies under the radar like that.
Yeah, I haven't heard of it either.
So So as this is KilmerCast, we should talk about your own experience with the Kilmer canon. What would you consider your favorite Val Kilmer film?
Oh, boy. That is a good question. There's so many. Maybe Tombstone.
Tombstone's a good choice.
Willow. He's always like kind of the best thing in the movie a lot of the time. I really like the movie that he made with Harmony Korine, The Fourth Dimension,
where
he
plays this one not many people himself. Mention.
Yeah, he rides a BMX bike, plays video games, he's like a motivational speaker, and it's just a short film. It's like a kind of an anthology movie with, is it three or four other directors contributed, but I just like the idea of him interpreting himself in such a way. And I saw that documentary, which I learned a lot.
It's a great
about
film
about him. Real Genius, also Top Secret, the early stuff, Top Gun. I mean, I'm like naming his whole IMDb.
I mean, you know, it's hard when you're a fan to pick just one Val Kilmer film.
Yeah.
But I definitely agree. You know, his early stuff is some of my favorite stuff, and that's why we did the show where I bounced back and forth between early and more recent stuff, because it's definitely, he was off balance when it comes to his career as a whole. His mm-hmm. early work way outshined his later work, even though there are a few gems here and there towards the end. But you know, if you want classic Kilmer, you know, you're gonna go way back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of like Batman, like that kind of stuff.
Not many people were.
Yeah.
So before we dive into today's film, we should go back in time.
Gather round as we put Kilmer in context.
So Red Planet hit theaters on November 10th, 2000. Very appropriately for this movie that we're covering today, the first resident crew actually entered the International Space Station at that time. You know, I don't think most people care about the International Space Station anymore. I mean, it just kind of feels like it's there, and it lost that sense of wonder because it's been there so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we hear about it when something goes wrong, but other than that, it's just kind of there.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that they shot a movie there now, it's the luster kind of off of it now, that you can just go and shoot movies at the International Space Station.
And like, anyone with a couple billion can just go to space now. It's so played out.
Yeah, it's like it used to be something that you dream of for your whole life, and now all you have to do is win a lottery, basically, and you get to go.
Yep.
Also at this time, Lion Sprague de Camp died at the age of 92. Do you know who Lion Sprague de Camp was?
No.
So he was a science fiction writer, and he actually wrote more than 100 novels. But most importantly, he was the first one to use the term extraterrestrial and ET to describe aliens. He set the stage for Steven Spielberg to follow in his footsteps.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's something you learn something new with KilmerCast. Also at this time, Hillary Clinton was elected to the United States Senate, becoming the first lady to win public office, which I was a bit surprised by, that no first lady before that had run for public office.
Hmm. And none has since, I don't think.
No, I don't believe so. And
other than Hillary for president, but.
Yeah, she's a two-time history maker. Mm-hmm. At this time also was the failed Millennium Dome Raid, which I don't know. Do you know the Millennium Dome Raid?
No.
Yeah. So this one I had no idea about until I started researching for the show to see what was going on around the time. So the Millennium Dome is this massive structure in London. They had around the time of the millennium, all these exhibitions and attractions and stuff. They were celebrating the new millennium. And part of it, there was a display of diamonds from De Beers that included the Millennium Star, which was this huge, flawless diamond worth about $460 million. So at this time, there was this gang of like seven guys in London who had a plan to steal the diamonds and then make a getaway on a speedboat on the Thames, which is like, you know, that's such a movie move.
Yeah, that sounds like a George Clooney movie.
Yeah, exactly. The problem was that they had tried to steal a couple of armored cars before this. So they were under surveillance by the police at this time. And so when they tried to make their move, the police put together this massive operation to shut them down and caught them just as they were breaking into the vault to steal the Millennium Star. Now, I'm amazed that we don't have a big movie about this yet, because it seems like it's ready made, like you said, a George Clooney film right in reality.
Ocean's 15, what are we up to now?
Yeah, they apparently made a British TV movie, but you know, come on, nobody really watches those here in America, at least. It's called The Great Dome Robbery. But I'm guessing, since nobody's really, I don't know anybody who's heard about it, it must not have done a very good job of telling the story.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So let's take a look at the top of the Billboard charts at the time. Leading the charts was one of, I think, everybody's favorite bands to hate, and that's Scott Stapp's Creed. And they had their biggest hit, Arms Wide Open. Do you remember that song?
I do.
You know, they claim that they're not a Christian band, but the song Arms Wide Open features him standing on a cliff with his arms wide open in a Jesus kind of pose. Kind of hard to make the claim that you're not a Christian band when this whole thing is like you're doing all this iconography of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my favorites.
No, but you know, oddly, I found out that Dave Grohl, the lead singer of the Foo Fighters, he considers this one of the most amazing songs of all time.
Wow.
That doesn't make sense to me.
It says something about Dave Grohl, maybe.
Maybe he has like a very sincere, like earnest streak inside of him that he like really connected with this song about, because the song is about, it was written by Scott Stapp about his soon to be born child. Uh-huh. Maybe he just has this like emotional connection to that kind of story, but man, like that song just like seems so bleh to me.
Wow. That was the top song of the year?
Well, at that time, that week.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And it was followed at number two by Madonna with Music. So this is part of her electronic music phase. It was a pretty good run, I think. I don't know if you remember this time for her. Mm-hmm. She had Beautiful Stranger and Ray of Light. Just some really solid songs, in my opinion. My favorite part of this song, though, is the video. I don't know if you remember the video for Music, but it featured Sacha Baron Cohen in his Ali G character.
Yes.
Now, this would have been way before Ali G made any impact in America. This is way before the HBO specials, way before his movies. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it was like to watch this video and see Ali G and as an American go, what is going on in England? Because this guy is insane.
So this must have been from the period when she was married to Guy Ritchie and was briefly British herself.
Yes, exactly.
Got it. She was ahead of that trend.
She was busy culturally appropriating.
Yeah.
Is that cultural appropriation when you're just stealing from, you know, fellow white people? I don't know.
I don't know. Putting on the fake accent is just pretty hilarious, though.
And she got away with it, which is an amazing thing for mm-hmm. so long. Nobody really, I mean, people joked about it, but nobody ever called her out about it.
That's true.
Then in number three was another band kind of in the style of Creed, and that was Three Doors Down with Kryptonite. Now this video is like so weird because it involves an elderly superhero who gets beat up by a group of sex workers because he's trying to help a woman get away from her pimp. And there's just something so disturbing at this video because this guy is like, he's in filth and just squalor. But then he tries to help this woman. It's a very strange thing. And the song itself is very odd. If you listen to the lyrics, he talks about, if I go crazy, will you still call me Superman? But I'm alive and well, will you hold my hand? I keep you by my side with my superhuman might. It sounds very controlling and weird. Like, it's like, what is this song really about?
Some video director took that Superman reference so literally and then made it weird.
It's very weird, and I mean, the song is okay. I mean, it's fine, but man, the video more than anything is what I remember about this song, and which is unfortunate because then, you know, all you care about is the video, then the song can't be that great.
Yeah, arguably better than Creed, I would say.
Yeah, but still only number three, so yeah. Unfortunate for them. So let's take a look at the TV charts. Yeah, it was kind of dull on TV at the time. You had American Idol in the top two spots. Then you had Hell's Kitchen and Dancing with the Stars taking up spots 6 and 7. And then the rest of the top 10 was very, standard stuff. Desperate Housewives, Grey's Anatomy, House. I mean, it was just like nothing that entertaining or interesting. I don't understand what happened to TV at that time. It was a time before, I guess, prestige television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, reality TV really had a moment, and then doctor shows were always popular, I guess.
Doctor shows, I think, will always be popular. I don't know what it is about doctor shows that people enjoy so much, because myself, I mean, yes, House was entertaining because of you, Lori, but Most of them, I'm like, okay, these are all the same thing with another medical, another emergency, and then, people having sex with each other.
Yeah, it must have been before, like, Sopranos, The Wire, like, really took off and got us. And now we have a million streaming channels, so we have too much TV now to pick from.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that this show wraps up just before the era of streaming, because trying to find ratings and figure out what's the top of the charts is almost impossible now with streaming, because nobody knows who actually watches anything.
Yeah, except for Squid Games, which everyone watched.
Apparently.
Yes.
According to Netflix, at least, everybody watched it. Yeah. Now, everybody's seen the memes.
Yeah, definitely.
So then over at the box office, Red Planet opened weekly at number 5. It only earned $10.6 million, but it was in 2,700 theaters, which is terrible. I mean, that's so bad. I can't imagine how much money this film lost.
Do you think some of that has to do with Mission to Mars that came out earlier that year and people assumed they'd already seen the movie?
I have to imagine that's part of the problem, because, I mean, and this is something that happened a lot, it seemed like, in the late 90s, early 2000s, which you had these parallel films like your Dante's Peak and Volcano.
Mm-hmm. And Armageddon.
Yeah,
Impact.
Exactly. Yeah. I wonder, you don't see that much anymore. I wonder why that was at that time that you had that. And what's funny is that, outside of Armageddon, which was massive, a lot of times they don't do that well, even though there's two of them. One of them, like, they both kind of just peter out. Mission to Mars didn't do particularly impressive numbers versus Red Planet, and neither Dante's Peak and Volcano, I don't think anybody remembers either one, except for the fact that they both came out around the same time.
Yeah, I'd say Dante's Peak, just because it has Linda Hamilton, who I love.
Pierce Brosnan too, right?
Pierce Brosnan, yeah. But it's just a little more ridiculous, but just a close call.
There was three films that opened wide that week, along with Adam Sandler's Little Nicky, which was not good. I remember seeing that in theaters. That opened in second place, earning $18.7 million, ahead of the Robert De Niro, Cuba Gooding Jr. film Men of Honor, which took in $17 million. However, none of them could beat the second week of the first Charlie's Angels movie, which was number one with $29 million.
I remember liking that one. That was a fun one.
That was an enjoyable film, but a real hodgepodge at the top of the charts. I mean, nothing like, all different films, dramas from Robert De Niro and Drew Barrymore and Cameron Diaz and Lucy Liu in an action film. Very strange week.
Yeah. Wow.
Then at number 4, you had the 6 week of Meet the Parents, which was, you don't see comedies last that long in the box office anymore. It crossed the $132 million mark. And then the top 10, I don't know if there's something about the time of this, maybe it's the new millennium was making people feel nostalgic or emotional or whatever, but there was a quartet of inspirational stories in the top 10, including The Legend of Bagger Vance, Remember the Titans, Pay It Forward, and Billy Elliot. It's kind of a real feel-good moment at the box office. And again, that doesn't happen anymore.
I'm sensing a parallel with the Creed song.
Yes.
People were looking for some... I don't know. I don't want earnest. To say snappy. Yeah, earnest.
Yeah, everybody's feeling real earnest at that around the holiday time. Maybe that was it. It was coming up to the holidays. People just wanted to toast their fellow man. And
I wonder if there was a big Halloween like movie that had come out in October that everyone had seen, and then they were moving on. I don't know.
We've had our fun. Now let's be serious.
Yeah.
And then in 10th place, you had the Brendan Fraser remake of the Dudley Moore comedy Bedazzled, which I actually remember enjoying at the time. Elizabeth Hurley, when she was a celebrity for that brief shining moment. Brendan Fraser, he was really fun for a while.
Yeah, he's making a comeback. They just cast him as the villain in the new Batgirl movie.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
For HBO Max, yeah. He's on Doom Patrol. I don't know. He's doing his thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's... quirky and weird, and I like that in an actor. I like somebody who wants to just do fun stuff.
Yeah, those Mummy movies were great.
They are fantastic. Way better than the Tom Cruise ones.
Yes.
One.
Yes.
They didn't make the other ones.
With good reason.
Absolutely. So we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back to talk about Red Planet. Welcome back to KilmerCast. Let's get into this film. So Red Planet story is written by Chuck Farrer, and the script was written by Jonathan Lemkin. Between the two of them, they really cover a memorable portion of the 90s action like filmography. Farrer had a string of cult successes. He did Barbed Wire, Hard Target, Navy SEALs. But most impressively, he did Darkman, which is a favorite of mine. I don't know how you feel about Darkman.
Oh, yeah. I love Sam Raimi. Really. Liam Neeson.
I mean, that's an enjoyable film.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Lemkin gave us The Devil's Advocate, Lethal Weapon 4, and an episode of Moonlighting. So he had his own bit going on there. And, you know, good for him. It's not the most admired body of work, I admit, between the two of them, but it's entertaining. That's the thing. Like, and that's what, you know, this movie should have been entertaining. You know, you're going to Mars with Val Kilmer and robots and all this stuff. And it feels like it just didn't work. And I think that's why Red Planet was Farr's last produced script to date. So 21 years, he hasn't done anything since then. And Lemkin had only one script produced after Red Planet, and that was the Mark Wahlberg film Shooter. So neither of them really succeeded beyond this film, unfortunately.
And I'm sure you're going to mention this was the director's only feature, correct?
Correct. Director yeah. Anthony Hoffman. Yeah, again, a guy who has not the longest resume. He got his first chance to make a movie was Red Planet, and his only film to date 21 years later. I mean, admittedly, he is a huge commercial director. He's done so many of the biggest commercials that you've seen, including the Budweiser Clydesdale spot, the original. That was him. And so, you know, like, you'd think he'd have more of an opportunity to make films. I mean, there's a lot of directors who jumped from commercials to movies, but not Anthony Hoffman. He made one movie and that was it. And that, like I said before, this movie only made $10 million in its opening weekend. And so maybe it plummeted so hard that it took all three of these guys out.
How much did it make in total?
Oh, I don't even know, because once I saw $10 million, I was like, well, it can't get any better. That's it. It's over.
Right, right.
Like, it wasn't like Red Planet climbed in the second week. It was the end of the road for Anthony yeah. Hoffman and company.
I can see that.
So to set up the film, which came out in 2000, so we have to remember this is 2000, we're told that the planet had got so polluted that we need to find a new home by 2025, which is now just 4 years away for us in reality, and feels very prescient because that could definitely be where we stand right now.
Yeah, and it's humankind's fault, obviously, which is what we're doing now, so... This movie could be real life.
Yeah, it may not have worked as an entertaining film, but maybe it was just a documentary before its time.
Yeah, let's hope not, but maybe.
Let's hope not. Well, scientists are working on building an atmosphere on Mars by using algae, but for some reason, the oxygen levels, which were good for a while with the algae, are now dropping. So they're trying to figure out, what do we do to fix this? So what they do is they send the first manned mission to Mars. And this features Captain Bowman, who's the female leader, played by Carrie Ann Moss of, like you said, The Matrix. Mm-hmm. Philosophizing science officer Chantillis, who's played by Terrence Stamp, a great character actor and all-around good bad guy. Two civilian scientists, Birchinol, played by Tom Sizemore, and Pettengill, played by Simon Baker. And the mechanic Gallagher, who's our man Val Kilmer.
And don't forget the hothead co-pilot.
Benjamin Bratt, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Benjamin Bratt, I actually forgot about. And that's probably because they're barely in the film.
Yeah. Simon Baker and Benjamin Bratt, what are they? You barely remember them.
Yeah. I mean, if you remove Benjamin Bratt from this film, I don't think it matters. I don't think anything changes at all.
Yeah. He's like an early social media star, his character is.
That's like there is really that line about website, thing. Right? Like, how many hits did your website get?
Yeah.
I guess even though it predicted that the world would, eventually collapse, they couldn't guess about Facebook.
Yeah. Carrie Ann Moss's character is also the narrator who gives us the exposition dump at the beginning and at the end, in case we missed any of that. So thank goodness for her.
Yeah, because otherwise she doesn't have a whole lot to do in this film. No. She fights a fire at one point and then hangs out and waits, which is odd because she doesn't feel like a leader. She doesn't feel like the captain of a ship. She feels more like a den mother watching over her kids who are off playing, you know, in the sandbox of Mars.
Yeah. And I felt like they had some questionable wardrobe choices for her. Like, she has like a see-through shirt on for like a lot of the part. And like, it's, you know, you can't not notice it.
Yeah, and we also one of the first times we meet her, she's in the shower.
Getting out of the shower, yes.
Yeah, which is a very strange scene with her and Val Kilmer, which I guess is supposed to intend to tell us that they had a shared history at some point, because they have a very awkward interaction as she gets out of the shower. But again, like, you combine all these things and it doesn't feel like she's the captain of the ship. She's like almost a mascot.
Yeah, and in no way did Red Planet need to shoehorn a romance into what was going on.
Yeah.
But it felt like it wanted to and it did, so.
Yeah, especially a romance between two characters who are almost never together in the film.
Yeah. I was pretty amazed. There's like that whole part where she's talking about how the best scientific minds, the international community has come together to like assemble this incredible team. And like, aside from Terrence Stamp, like what, these guys are all like kind of jerks.
Absolutely.
Kind of make bad decisions, felt selfish. It's like the international community couldn't do better. Like they literally say, the hope and survival of mankind rests on us. I'm like,
oh boy.
Really?
We are in big trouble.
They're like making vodka in the lab.
Yeah, they have a still. I mean, like in space, you're going to make a still? I mean, and Carrie Ann Moss makes it very clear. That's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Like, we do not need this in the spaceship.
Yeah. But then she takes a drink because she's like, cool. But
yeah, she wants to fit in with her friends.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know if that would really happen. Maybe. I don't know.
I don't think so. Yeah. One of the things that bothered me about all these characters is their names. Like, they all, I know that these are all militaristic people. It's supposedly a very military storyline here because they're all in part of the space mission. But you know, you're all hanging out for 6 months on your way to Mars. Maybe use your first names. And so names that I could understand, because everybody's name is complicated. Birchinol and Pettingill and Shantatals or whatever. You know what? For this show, I think we'll just use their real names and keep it a lot clearer who's who.
Yeah. Although Gallagher for Val Kilmer is kind of perfect because he's like the wacky Hawaiian shirt, sunglasses guy.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a part he's played several times now, I feel like.
Yeah. He's basically real genius grown up going to Mars is what I thought.
But a janitor, apparently.
A space janitor, yes. Yeah. He'll allow you to call him that, apparently.
So, you know, like so much sci-fi that is set on a spaceship, there's an AI in this film, as I mentioned before. And here we have Lucille. I feel like they could have done so much more with Lucille than just use her to explain the dangers that they're facing. I mean, you have to consider that Moss spends almost the entirety of the film by herself with this AI. A little personality with her would have helped Moss maybe have a character, maybe have some good time, maybe have some, maybe just have a scene that's worthwhile while the other guys are off on the planet.
I tried to find who the voice of Lucille was, and I couldn't find anyone credited. I wonder how they recorded that.
Yeah, and maybe it's just some grip or, you know, somebody's wife on the production team. That usually how it works. You don't have a credited part.
They credited the women that phoned in to say hi to Benjamin Bratt, but they did not credit a voice for Lucille. I was shocked.
Yeah, that's a very strange decision to make. It's, you know, and like I said, AI is a huge part of sci-fi, and you know, and is a big part of this film. And you know, you look at a film like Moon. You watched Moon, mm-hmm. right? With Sam Rockwell.
Yep.
A good AI makes a story about one person so much more bearable, and you know, makes it more entertaining. And they just did nothing with Lucille.
Yeah, she could have been a little sassier. I don't know. Absolutely. She's just very rote.
She's just ship's computer. It's very annoying. Well, so the beginning of this film, it's all about introducing all these various crew members and showing how they relate to each other, and you know. So you have Stamp, he's the crotchety one, and Sizemore's the aggressive one, and Kilmer is laid back, and then Moss is whoever Moss is. And, you know, like, beyond that, there's no point to this beginning. We don't learn any character background. It's just that they are personalities inside of these spacesuits. There's no actual, I don't think we learned anything much about any of them, did we?
We learned that Gallagher's grandfather taught him to navigate using the stars. There's a little anecdote there. I think that's pretty much, maybe Tom Sizemore's character had an ex-wife or something, but yeah, not a lot of information. And then Simon Baker's character, they're literally like, he was a last minute replacement.
Mm.
Like, or why, we don't know.
Yeah, and I thought they were going to do something with that because, and as we learn in the film, he's the weasel. He's the guy who every sci-fi film has, who is a cowardly little, you know, snit, and he's going to be the problem always because he's got his own little thing going on. And but, you know, I thought maybe he replaced somebody in like some sort of secret plan or something, but no, he's just a jerk who they brought on board.
And they're all, I mean, aside from Terrence Stamp, who's obviously British, they're all Americans. So I don't know, if you made this movie today, you would definitely have more diversity.
Oh, certainly.
Among the cast, different nations would be represented. And
and arguably a lot more entertaining.
A little more interesting. Yeah, I think.
So the ship arrives at Mars after their introduction phase, and all hell just breaks loose because the 5-man crew heads down to the surface to investigate the oxygen situation. But there's a solar flare that's going to destroy the ship, and it sets off fires and turns off the gravity system. I mean, admittedly, it's a kind of a cool scene where Carrie Ann Moss is fighting fires while floating around a spaceship. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And I thought the way of getting rid of the fire by opening up the hatch and letting it fly out into, you know, oxygen lacking, empty space, that's a good idea. But, you know, while that's happening on the ship, the landing vehicle crash lands in what I think you can only describe as a slapstick comedy sequence. Did you think that thing was ever going to stop falling off cliffs?
No. And, it was amazing that only one person got seriously injured out of that.
I mean, it must roll for 2-3 miles, I think, because it just keeps going off cliffs, off cliffs, off cliffs, off cliffs. And then finally, when they do arrive at a stop, they find out that Terrence Stamp has been mortally wounded.
Yeah.
And it's like, why did we have Terrence Stamp in this role?
I wondered that as well, because they bring him in, he gives a couple of speeches like about philosophy and God, and then he dies. So
yeah. And I mean, yes, they do. I think Tom Sizemore references him once later in the film when they talk about God and philosophy versus science. But beyond that, he has no impact on this plot in any way.
Yeah. But there's a character we haven't mentioned yet. I'm sure you're getting to that. My favorite character other than Gallagher is... I'm sure you're going to talk about it, but Amy,
the robot other explorer.
Female robot.
Yeah,
there's called Sweetie early in the movie.
I'm sure there's a college thesis that we could write about the gender, mechanics of this film, because, you know, everybody who is, not one of the core guys is a female character, quote unquote female character, Lucille the AI and Amy the robot. So there's something happening there in the writers' minds where they have some weird hang up about women. But yes, Amy is a robot explorer, and in my opinion, the biggest missed opportunity of this film, because Amy has two modes. She can be an explorer or a military mode, which is a straight up killing machine. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was really cool. I thought they did a nice job with this character and like the special effects work and everything. I don't know how you felt about it, but I thought the movement was really impressive on it.
Yeah, the effects looked good. I mean, even for a movie made in 2000 or 1999, whenever they made it. But I do think it's hilarious that, again, all the entire hope of like the future of humanity rests on this mission. And the robot they bring literally has a switch that you can just toggle between navigation mode and like, I'm a murderous, like nightmare robot that's gonna kill everyone, like with using strategy programmed into me by the military. Like, what? Did no one think maybe they could just take that part out? Like, I did not understand. I mean, on loan from the military, I get it, but like, there had to have been a way that they could have disabled that, because Amy causes them a lot of problems.
as you point out, they crash land, and it damages Amy and she gets stuck in kill mode. Real problem.
Who would have guessed that would have happened?
Nobody could have guessed.
Certainly
that.
Certainly not.
I mean, and there's no override, there's no fail safe, there's no nothing. It's just, we are stuck with a killer robot. And that's my biggest issue with this movie, is that you have a killer robot, you have these four guys on this planet, and the movie somehow doesn't become a sci-fi slasher where the killer robot is hunting them each down until the final confrontation. That should have been this movie.
Yeah, they tease you like it's going to be like that. But then there's nematodes, which I'm sure we're going to talk about. There's all kinds of problems. Simon Baker steals the radio. Like, just human error, all kinds of things.
Yeah, this really should have just been a straight up slasher with a killer robot, like Chopping Mall or something like that. You know, like it could have been so much fun and so tense. They just, I don't know why they were so worried about these freaking people on this planet, because they are unfortunately the focus and they're not that interesting and they don't do much.
As you pointed out, they're basically just cardboard cutouts. Like they would have been perfect for a slasher. Like if she started picking them off.
Yeah.
Be perfect. Just leave Val Kilmer at the end and that's what happens anyway. So
yeah, they have all the framework of it, but they don't have the meat, the stuff that we really wanted to watch. And that's what really hurts about this film, because you can see what could have been and it's not there, because what we end up with is them looking for shelter and food and finding out it's been destroyed somehow. Don't know why, we'll find that out later. So now the team has no way to survive. But meanwhile, Simon Baker and Benjamin Bratt are off, you know, exploring, and Baker kills Bratt. And I'm like, wait, if Baker was doing this on purpose, sure, it would be great. Like if he was trying to had some reason to knock off the other guys. So now it's, you know, Baker versus Amy to see who can kill more of the team. Mm-hmm. That might have been really entertaining, but he's just the usual cowardly guy.
Yeah, they definitely could have leaned more into the horror and it would have been more entertaining.
So things get even worse though for them, because they realize that their oxygen is running out. And I thought we were going to get a Total Recall head explosion, and we didn't, because Kilmer pops open his helmet and realizes he can breathe. And apparently there's oxygen on Mars. I mean, I thought they could hold this for a little later in the film as a bit of a twist. They show this real early, and it has no benefit other than they can walk around without their helmets on.
Right. The other benefit is that we're free from the tiresome, we're running out of oxygen plot, which was getting old, but Terrence Stamp maybe could have lived. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, but, and like, so oxygen is an issue, but you know, the rules of Mars are all over the place in this film, because at one point they actually talk about peeing in anti-gravity and how it's like, you know, different or whatever, but low gravity has no effect on anything else they do. Yeah. Nothing. They throw stuff to each other with no effect. They like, they don't jump around. This movie could take place in Arizona and be almost the same film.
Yeah. The gravity thing is very curious. They didn't address that at all. I think they just wanted to have the line, taking the first piss on Mars. Like somebody wrote that and was like, that's going in the movie. And like
Chuck Farr is like, I got it. This is the entire movie built around this one moment.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of lines that if this was a better movie would be like memorable lines, but that's one of them.
So once they figure out what's going on this planet, at least they think they know what's going on this planet, the rest of the movie is just a lot of side quests. And you have this ticking clock of Moss, like she can't find them on the planet. So she's like, and Houston's telling her, hey, you got to go. And so you have this worry that she's going to have to leave because she can't find them. And if she can't find them, she can't take them back. But other than that, like all it is just like, hey, we need to find the rover. Hey, we need to find the shuttle, the thing, the Russian thing. It's just a lot of, hey, can we find this? Hey, can we find that? There's nothing else action-wise in this film for the most part.
It's true. And the idea that they would go all the way there and then they would fail getting down to the surface and then she would just go back without them seems pretty wild. Like, again, the fate of humanity, like, you think they would have sent like two ships or something. I don't know.
We're better people, you know, not civilians, you know, like,
I mean,
you want to send all military guys who can survive this.
Yeah. I mean, there was no backup plan at all. They're just improvising on the surface with like the old Russian whatever it was like thing that was already there to help them out. And I don't know, even Star Wars had two Death Stars, like, come on guys.
And like they did, I missed it, but why didn't they have a way to communicate with her? Did it get destroyed in the crash? Because they end up finding the rover and taking its modem out in order to be able to talk to her on the ship, which of course works, like some ancient modem. They point out that it doesn't even work on the same frequencies that they use nowadays, but somehow they managed to make it work so they can talk to Carrie Ann Moss. And I'm like, wait, like you didn't have a backup for your communication when you're going down to the surface of Mars?
Yeah, I mean, part of the time she was like on the dark side, like out of the range. And then they were in like this ice storm or whatever it was.
The size of Montana.
Yeah. Yes. Very specific, American specific. But yeah, there, I feel like at a certain point when you're watching this movie, you just have to kind of stop asking like, why? Cause then why are you even watching it at all?
Is the moment when you stop asking why, when they find the quote unquote nematodes?
Man. I mean, I know, I'm sure we were going to get into the notorious feud between Kilmer and Sizemore while they were filming this, but like, they're kind of a buddy team. Like they have that old nematode, like, you know, they kind of figure it out together, and like Sizemore like sacrifices himself, and this is a shame. Like off screen, apparently they couldn't even be in the same shot, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I know Kilmer has a reputation for being difficult to work with, and Sizemore has a reputation for being a complete psychopath. But you know, you'd think they could pull it together after Heat. I mean, come on, guys, you know. But the nematodes. Okay, so I'm not a scientist. I don't claim to be a scientist. I did not do well in science in school. I know that a nematode is not an insect like that. Why would a film so baked in science do something so dumb as to call a bug like that a nematode?
Maybe for the same reason why they named the characters such hard to pronounce, like hard to remember names. I'm not sure. I mean, they had to come up with some reason that they could breathe and where the algae had gone. And then it sounds kind of sci-fi-y. I don't know.
It definitely sounds sci-fi-ish, but you could have just come up with something. Nobody was questioning, like, if you called them the Zingzats, you know, like, it would just be like, well, I mean, I'd hope it'd be better than Zingzats, but I mean, something that you can just be like, hey, look at that bug. And like, oh, that bug's freaky. Yeah, like, that's... Mm-hmm. You didn't need to call them something that people actually know are actual bugs or actual creatures, I should say. It's a very odd choice to be so wrong on purpose almost.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, as we mentioned the bugs, so they find the algae, which is on another part of the planet, and they find out that these bugs have been eating everything. When they eat, they expel oxygen. And so they are creating this atmosphere. So this is a huge find because they could possibly rebuild Earth's atmosphere and colonize Mars using these bugs. But unfortunately, the bugs ate Baker, and they're also going to eat Sizemore. And they are creepy. I mean, there's no doubt these are some freaky looking bugs. And when they swarm Sizemore and eat through his suit, I got some severe heebie-jeebies from this.
Yeah, again, a horror element there, bringing it in. It is very freaky. And then they explode when you put them near a flame. So there's also that visual element to it.
Yeah, the little fireworks coming out of Baker's body when they light him on fire. That's some fun stuff, and I hate that there's fun stuff in this movie that they just let go to waste because they couldn't tell the core story. And that core story, Amy does come back to the story, because when they are hiding away from the ice storm that you mentioned, Baker steals the radio and he's going to get away and he's going to try to get back to the ship, but Amy has other plans, because Amy hunts him down and actually broadcasts the kill to Kilmer and Sizemore, which I thought was a really interesting and disturbing touch for this film.
Yeah, and he also didn't need to steal the radio, because Val Kilmer's character made it very clear that Val Kilmer was gonna stay, Tom Sizemore and Simon Baker were gonna be the two that were gonna be able to go back, because only two dudes could like fit in the escape pod or whatever. Mm-hmm. And yet he still decided he needed to run off. So then we get the kill scene, which is kind of worth it.
It's definitely worth it, but as you mentioned, say that, it makes zero sense.
Yeah. So
so if you have this bug that is a core portion of this storyline, why is there no build up to it? Why is there no real presence for these things? They are in the film for almost maybe 3 minutes at a whole, and they are essentially the crux of the storyline. It's almost like as if you introduced Jaws an hour into the film and then killed him immediately. You know, this is what the main threat of this movie is, are these bugs, and they're also the main reason they are there.
Mm-hmm. And they do manage to scoop up a couple to bring him back. Unfortunately, we never got Red Planet 2, The Journey Home, in which the bugs probably overtook Earth. But and they didn't eat Amy too. I guess they didn't eat the metal.
Very good point. Why wouldn't they eat Amy when they ate the Hab?
Yeah. They wanted those tomatoes, I guess. They were growing.
Well, I guess it's good that they didn't eat her, because we still have her. And she's very important to making sure that Kilmer can get back to the ship. Yes. Because the spacecraft that they found, the Russian spacecraft, doesn't have any power. So Kilmer, super smart guy, real genius. He tricks Amy into attacking him and then gets the upper hand somehow. This killer robot, military robot, gets tricked by this space janitor, and he ends up taking her battery, and then she gloriously self-destructs, which once you take her battery, how is she managing that? I don't know. I'm not quite sure how that works, but she does manage to blow up herself, and one last final hurrah of the bad guys on this planet.
Would have been awesome if at the end, like when Bowman and Gallagher are back up on the ship, they had revealed that there was like a second Amy.
Okay, so you say that. You say that. That's funny that you mentioned that. What if they combined Amy and Lucille?
Oh, see, that would have been perfect.
Yeah, I mean,
they would have communicated if they're both robot ladies,
right? I mean, Moss and Kilmer had to fight her on both from both sides, on both fronts, and like they were working, you know, against the same villain and having to fight her in different ways, and maybe teaming up from different perspectives to beat her. I mean, that then she would have had Amy's interesting portion of her. Lucille could have had more of a personality and more of a presence in the film. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't thought about that until you said it, but yes, I think they should have done that.
I mean, that's one of the core rules of screenwriting is simplify. Make everything as straightforward as possible so that the audience can really dig into it, and you don't have padding. You don't have a lot of wasted time. And I think Lucille and Amy combining the two, especially if Amy could talk, how frightening would that be?
Yeah. That would be terrifying. And any story where like the ship turns on the passengers is like, I love that. Like Event Horizon, movies like that. I love that. That's a horror movie for sure.
Oh, absolutely. So, well, either way, he manages to launch himself using the power from Amy, and it doesn't go as hoped. He ends up almost dying in space, and Moss has to save him and catches, you know, his nearly dead body out in space, and then revives him because, of course, you know, like she's got to be the den mother, so she saves the day. And they can make that trip back to Earth for 6 months. And like you said before, they force this romance into this film because in the end she says, well, I got 6 months. I can get to know the janitor.
Yeah. That's her triumph in this movie.
<It's> She wins the janitor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, this movie has really cool special effects in it, and it has some really good ideas in it. But the overall execution is just bland and disappointing and lacking in any character or plot.
Yeah. And I actually had looked up the cinematographer because I was... the movie looks good, but it's the guy who did Mars Attacks, funnily enough, but he also is like David Cronenberg's go-to guy, like,
oh, come on.
Like Dead Ringers. So he did like Existence and History of Violence, and like, I don't know, the talent was there. It was just the story just couldn't quite hold it up, I guess.
I'm picturing him on set going, what am I doing here?
Yeah, pretty much. Just get another shot of Kilmer in those Elvis glasses.
Is there anything about this film that we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to say?
I just mentioned Elvis because when he gets back to the ship, he says, I saw Elvis. And I was like, is that a True Romance reference? Or
it might be. or just Kilmer. You know, he likes to have fun like that.
Yeah.
Well, we've had our say, so we need to hear from some other people.
Come, children. Let's explore the kills and valleys.
So Kills and Valleys, the best and worst reviews of this film. Well, on Rotten Tomatoes, this film is 14% fresh, which is expected after watching it, but it still seems fairly rough, 14%. I don't know. What do you think?
I feel like Red Planet has not become a cult beloved movie, which could bump it up a little bit. Like, I don't know if it ever will be. So 14, that's, I mean, for people who even remember the movie at all, I don't know. 14 seems fair.
Well, Roger Ebert was one of the few critics to actually embrace the film. He was really, yeah. I mean, he had some weird choices sometimes, Roger Ebert. There were some films he just, you know, clung on to and just like, this is my movie. And often it was a sci-fi film because he really had a real taste for sci-fi. And he said, like in 1950s sci-fi, the story's strong point isn't psychological depth or complex relationships, probably because neither of them are there, but brainy scientists trying to think their way out of a box that grows smaller every minute. To like that kind of story is to like this kind of movie. I don't know if I see anything about brainy scientists in these movies. I mean, there's not that much smart in this film.
Yeah, brainy seems generous.
I don't consider Tom Sizemore to be, a Mensa.
I think like Gallagher's MacGyvering of the stuff, like at the end, that's probably the brainiest the movie gets.
Yeah, I would agree. Kevin Thomas of the LA Times was less enthused about the film, noting how the film succeeds technically, but not in character. The crew on the whole is so lacking in personality that it seems conceivable that Red Planet might just play better with the dialogue track turned off.
I can see that.
That's a rough one. And then Bob Graham of the San Francisco Chronicle downright hated Red Planet. If the people who made Red Planet can't figure out what it's all about, how can we? My advice to moviegoers is to take the scattered best moments of Red Planet and put them together into a better movie themselves. And I agree.
That feels like what we just did.
Yeah, exactly. You just got to combine Amy and Lucille and you're all set.
Yes.
Over on Amazon, the unwashed masses have left us 2,115 reviews, of which 64% are 5 stars.
Is that a lot of reviews? What's the average going?
Depends. Chilmerk films get a lot of reviews for some reason. He has a lot of fans out there. Mm-hmm. But for a film that I don't think most people remember for the most part, that's a lot of reviews.
Wow.
But the 64% 5-star is upsetting.
I'm intrigued by this.
There have been quite a few Mars-oriented movies the last few years, some better, some worse. While The Martian is hands down the best, Red Planet still has a place in my heart. Somebody who enjoys The Martian and Red Planet is an interesting person.
Wow, a Mars completist. I bet they like Santa Claus versus the Martians, as I do.
And Mom Needs Mars.
Oh yeah,
Mars Needs Moms.
That is a diabolical movie. Ooh, I can't believe it's for kids.
I did not know what to expect from a sci-fi movie made in the year 2000 that I'd never heard of before, but I was drawn to watch it because of Carrie Ann Moss and Val Kilmer. And from the beginning, it was a tiny bit unreal. That's a stretch. But it got more and more real as it progressed. It really is a good movie storyline, and the acting of all characters is lifelike and believable under those circumstances. It is really entertaining, and most of all, the special effects are really darn good. I don't know.
I wonder what other movies that person has seen.
I would love to see. I really should go through their reviews and see what else they're watching, because boy, oh boy, oh boy. This one, I just like enjoyed the headline. Makes me wish I had joined NASA.
Huh. Okay.
It's a good recruiting tool, Red Planet. Yeah,
I feel like there's not a lot of NASA mentioned in the movie.
I don't think it's ever mentioned.
But yeah, maybe NASA was like, we are not a part of this.
Leave our name out of this.
Yeah.
If you're a sci-fi fan or like this movie, pick it up. It's a good, good way to go about things. If you like the movie, watch it.
Put it on in the background while you're folding laundry.
As much as it might be sad to say, I love this movie. I'm a big Val Kilmer fan for some reason, and the way they go to the story is great. That's a very interesting person. They're sad they like the movie and they like Val Kilmer, but I have no idea why.
Wow. Maybe Lucille wrote that one.
So 2% of the reviews were 1-star. That's very low and very upsetting as well. The science in this thing is so soft, you could spread it on toast. You got one of the scientists who did not enjoy the film.
Mm-hmm.
Science so bad, you have to see it to believe it. Plot holes big enough for Jupiter to fall through. Concepts more ridiculous than anything Monty Python has ever made. And it's all unintentionally hilarious.
I wish it had been more hilarious.
It should have been way worse.
It doesn't quite get to that so good, so bad it's good level.
No, it does not. It's just so bad it's bad.
Yeah.
After having to endure 107 minutes of terrible acting, horrendous dialogue, and a story so flat it'd make the Great Plains look rocky, I can only hold my head in shame, as I admit I purchased this DVD without previewing it first.
Well, that's on them.
Absolutely. There are reviews online you can read. This wasn't like, you know, the year 1980 when you had no idea.
Yeah, there's 2,000 reviews you could read.
Let's send a bunch of losers to a planet inhabited by cockroaches and watch them all die one by one. Well, one gets tossed off a cliff. However, I personally think he jumped after he saw the screener for his own movie. The robot was the only good thing about this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel that.
I'm a big fan of Amy.
Yes.
So we have a question to answer.
With or without Val.
Do you think this movie is made or broken by Val Kilmer?
Ooh, I mean, I think he's the best human character. He's the only one with any personality.
Mm.
He's the only one with any shred of backstory other than you get a little Terrence stamp.
Very little.
He brings the humor. I'm not quite sure if he realizes what kind of movie he's in, that he knows it's such a bad movie, but he seems to be having fun sometimes.
Yeah, like most bad movies that Val Kilmer's in, he makes it at least bearable to watch because he himself is somewhat entertaining in most things. He has a magnetic presence that I keep watching even though the film is so terrible. I know, admittedly, that this is Kilmer Cast, so I watch almost anything with Val Kilmer in it, but you know, he raises the level of a film like this, but he could not make this film. I'm sorry.
Yeah, imagine if it had been some other actor of that time. I can't even think of who they would put in there, Matthew Broderick or something.
Oh, it would have been so brutal to sit through this movie.
Would have made $5 million instead of 10.
Well, it's time to play a game, which is simply called Moon or Mars. So there are two planets that filmmakers are fascinated by, and that's the Moon and Mars. So now most of the films that are about Moon or Mars are named about those planets. So you have, like you said before, Mission to Mars, you have A Trip to the Moon, but there are a lot of them that are less upfront. So I'm going to give you the name of the film and a synopsis, and you're going to try to tell me if it's a movie about Mars or a movie about the Moon.
Okay.
Okay. So here's your sci-fi test. We'll see if your bona fides are. So the first one from 2021 is Settlers. Mankind's earliest space settlers do what they must to survive the cosmic elements and each other.
Oh, that's Mars.
You are correct.
I saw that Mars. One. Yeah.
This one you may not have seen, probably have not seen. Way, Way Out from 1966. In a futuristic world, the U.S. decides to send a married couple of astronauts to its space base to prevent an improper contact with Soviet female cosmonauts.
Wow, I need to see that. I'm going to guess Moon for that one.
You would be correct. It is the Moon. 2 for 2. How about this one? Apollo 18 from 2011. Decades-old found footage from NASA's abandoned Apollo 18 mission, where three American astronauts were sent on a secret expedition.
I think that was Moon. Is it Moon?
It is Moon. Yes, it is. 3 for 3.
I remember that one. Yeah, that was like a kind of a horror found footage space thing.
Yeah, why they never went back. Okay, 2019's Ad Astra. An astronaut seeks to uncover the truth about his missing father and his doomed expedition that now threatens the universe.
That's the Moon, because I remember they had moon pirates.
That one, right? Is actually about Mars.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes.
A little tricky one there. That's like the Brad Pitt, Tommy Lee Jones one?
Yeah.
Did they go to the Moon at some point, though?
Yes, they do. They do go to the Moon, but it's mostly about Mars.
But the ultimate destination is Mars.
Okay. Yep.
So it's like mostly Mars, a little bit of a Moon.
So I'll give you half credit.
Okay. Give me a 0.5.
Mission Stardust, 1967. Mm. A team of astronauts is sent to rescue an alien who is seeking help to save her dying race. They are attacked by a force of bandit robots and discover that enemy spies are out to kill the alien.
Wow. I have no idea. It could be either. I'll guess Mars.
It is Moon. Oh, the alien was on the Moon.
Wow.
How about
robot bandits? That sounds good.
Yeah, bandit robots, I'm all for. Maybe Amy's one of them.
Yes.
2017's Space Between Us. The first human born in space travels to Earth for the first time, experiencing the wonders of the planet through fresh eyes.
That was Mars.
You are correct. That is, yes, Mars. Stowaway from 2021. A three-person crew faces an impossible choice when an unplanned passenger jeopardizes the lives of everyone on board.
I think that was also Mars.
And you would be? Correct. It is Mars. You are very good at this.
That was a Netflix, Anna Kendrick. I remember that one. Yeah.
How about 1989's Beyond the Stars? A teenage boy befriends a retired astronaut who harbors secrets from his trip to space.
I'm going to say Moon for that one, but I'm not sure.
Well, your gut is correct. It is Moon. That one with Christian Slater as the teenage boy.
Oh, wow. I haven't seen that one.
No, me neither. I kind of want to watch it now.
Oh my gosh. What year was that?
1989.
Oh, wow. Okay. Early Slater.
How about John Carter from 2012? A Civil War veteran hides in a cave where he is transported to another planet and becomes embroiled in a conflict there.
Mars.
I would hope you would get that right. Yes. Yes. John Carter of Mars.
Yes.
And then the last one, The Adventures of Pluto Nash from 2002. In the future, a man struggles to keep his space nightclub out of the hands of the mafia.
Ooh, I'm pretty sure that's Mars also.
It is a lunar space club.
Oh,
so it is the moon.
Sorry, Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, threw in that Pluto Nash for a little trickery.
I blocked that one out, but yes.
Moon, I don't blame, okay, you. Well, that's it for this episode of KilmerCast. I'd like to thank you, Cheryl, for joining me to chat about this film. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
No, just check out Io9 and Gizmodo for, if you are interested in seeing me blabber more about stuff, mostly horror, but once in a while sci-fi and sometimes Val Kilmer.
In our next episode, we'll be checking out the 2008 action drama Conspiracy. And in the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter @KilmerCast. For myself and my guest, Cheryl Eddy, thank you for listening and remember to keep it Kilmer.